Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Today, we have a summary of Jay Shetty podcast. In this episode, Jay Shetty explores the complexities of social interactions and the psychology behind cancel culture. He delves into how our environments influence our expressions and the importance of understanding our audience in a divided society. This conversation invites listeners to reflect on their own experiences and the challenges of engaging in uncomfortable discussions. Remember to follow us on X and Instagram and on our website, podsummarizer.xyz. And now, let's begin.
If you're in a certain room with people that you know you're very comfortable with, there are sides of you that you're going to be expressing versus not. We call it reading the room, understanding your environment, understanding your audience, understanding the timing of certain things. Saying everything and saying nothing are not the only options. Instead of saying this on social media, could I tell a friend? We believe that if something is happening socially or there's a crisis, people need to take their stance online. Self-censoring is actually when you rush to say something because you want to keep the mob at bay. If you repost this infographic, then we know you're a safe person, so the mob doesn't attack you. So it's actually not about whether someone believes what they're saying. We are more interested in the performance of things.
The number one health and wellness podcast.
Jay Shetty.
Jay Shetty.
The one, the only Jay Shetty.
The gamut of themes that you cover in this book are what's so deeply needed for hearts and minds in the world right now, where we're living in an age of intolerance. We're living in a society of divide. We're scared of having uncomfortable conversations. We don't know how to talk to someone who thinks differently from us. And whether this is religiously, politically, even if it comes down to career-wise, like, I think we have created a world where we have silos and groups. But if I had to start somewhere, my question would be, how did we get here?
Even in writing this book, I had to lead with that question because it's one of the first questions that people ask me. And very specifically, what we're talking about the psychology of what we call cancel culture, which is important for me to actually name this very early in our conversation. And I invite people, just as I said those words, to be honest about how that felt in your body, because there are people that believe cancel culture is not real, it doesn't exist, it's simply people being held to account. And then there are some people that believe that it's a combination of public shaming, doxing, the inability to disagree well, self-righteousness, all of these are the more shadowy things. But what I really got to discover for myself in this 3.5 years of writing this, but I would say the 5 years before it, it's not a new problem. And I don't know if you've found this, where sometimes we think what we're experiencing in our timeline is something new. I think it's just a modern manifestation of tribalism. I think we've always had silos and echo chambers and divide and polarization. It just looked very differently 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago. But I think just because something has existed for centuries, I think just because something might be primal, the biology of wanting to belong and what we're willing to do in order to belong, I don't think that means we need to normalize it not working. So I think there's a combination of things that I'll just kind of put forward to answer your question in a more direct way. It's not a new problem. So I can't say this is exactly when it started. It's ancient. It's tribalism. We're just experiencing it in a very different way in modern day society.
Yeah, no, that's really well put. You're so right. We always feel our problems are unique.
Yeah, we do.
And that no one has felt them before. And that what we're experiencing is the most extreme version of it.
Yes, yes.
Where does that come from? Where's that feeling of like, what I'm going through has to be the worst, most, highest, deepest?
The thing that you're pointing out, that question, allows for me to actually have empathy for human beings and empathy for myself in realizing that all I know is my story. All I know is my experience. I am living in my body and my mind. I have no idea what anyone else is experiencing. So whether I feel grief or pain or arousal, joy, it's a very solitary experience. So I think it's so easy to believe that we are the only ones experiencing these things. Even when someone says, I'm experiencing that too, I experience fear. I have a fear of being cancelled, of being ostracized, of whatever. We can only understand it intellectually, but we never fully understand it in an embodied way. And something that I would also say around this is that when it comes to this thing that we call cancel culture, I truly believe that it's underpinned by self-censorship, which I'm sure we'll speak about in more detail. But self-censorship is essentially when you feel that you're going to be punished for expressing yourself honestly, whether it's even in how you dress. Let's say you're from a culture that's very conservative, but you've wanted to express yourself in a way that is deemed inappropriate, in a way that is deemed maybe men shouldn't wear this, women shouldn't wear this, whatever it is, you believe that you're going to be punished for your expression. And I think the problem is that with technology, we see that level of fear just in a very different way. So again, these things have always existed, but social media amplifies these things just in a way that is very, very abnormal. I would say actually that's one of the things that I really got to see for myself, even before this book, that social media is making us behave and experience some of these things in a way we just never would. It's making us speak to each other in a way we never normally would, criticize in a way we wouldn't, put forward this idea of moral perfection in a way we wouldn't, but it's also making us self-censor in a way we just wouldn't in our everyday lives.
We even say things like, oh, I'd never say this online.
Yeah.
Or I really can't say this on Instagram, but I'll say it here, or this is the right room to talk about this. Yes. We say things like that all the time. What is that line between self-censorship and then this idea of trying to be fully transparent and authentic? Like this idea that if you share everything, then you're authentic.
Yeah.
And if you hide something, then where's self-censorship different to both of those?
Yes.
Because it's not either or.
I write a line where I say, and I start to use this as a mantra for myself, saying everything and saying nothing are not your only options. I think that's very important. Self-censorship is driven by fear. Again, you believe on some level, usually very unconscious, that you are going to be punished if you express what is true. If I am honest with you right now, you are going to ostracize me. You're going to abandon me. You're going to reject me. But now we're not just doing it to an individual level. You're doing it with strangers, faceless, nameless people. You're afraid that they're going to cast you out of the tribe, right? So it taps into a very primal fear, which is so normal. It's just being expressed in a way that is not normal at all, right? So self-censorship is driven by fear. Whereas I think the other side of that is, I call it social filtering. It's something that we do all the time. You and I, if we're meeting for the first time, there might be things that you just won't say or jokes that you just won't make because we don't know each other well enough just yet. If you're in a certain room with people that you know you're very comfortable with, there are sides of you that you're going to be expressing versus not. That's reading the room. We call it reading the room, understanding your environment, understanding your audience, understanding the timing of certain things. That is discernment led. It's not led by fear. So I never want people to think that any of...
Having navigated the complexities of self-censorship and social filtering, the conversation shifts to the impact of social media on our primal instincts, revealing how our online personas often clash with our true selves.
I speak at it just from a very different point of view to highlight that these things that are already primal within us, that have already existed within us, just get a different stage because of social media. And I think it's something to be curious about. But I find that because of that kind of shame we feel, because we know we're not morally perfect, because we know that behind closed doors, there are things that we agree with that other people would look down on us for, or the person that we used to be, that maybe we've been able to cover them up quite well and no one else knows, but there's the shame that can still lie beneath. Whereas on social media, we get to create this morally perfect person who posts all of the right infographics, all of the right links, all of the right things. They always have the right opinion. They're somewhat of a 24-hour news cycle as well. So when something is happening, they're up to date on everything. They're educated, right? All of this. But a lot of the time, it's in direct contradiction to who we actually are. But we're so wedded to that morally perfect avatar that we expect other people to also have one of their own. So if someone shows a side of them that is a little bit unsavory or a little bit inappropriate, or someone who doesn't agree with something and is willing to say it, I think we experience this kind of cognitive dissonance because a mirror has been held up. I find that sometimes it's almost like a, how dare you say what is on your mind when I can't? Mm-hmm. A lot of the time, it's kind of this frustration that we have. How dare you be free when I am in a cage that I have constructed for myself? It's not the story for everyone, but I promise you, it's the common story. If you were to look just a little bit deeper to say, why do I feel these reactions so strongly when someone doesn't match my worldview? What feels so threatening? And sometimes it's someone's freedom of expression that feels threatening. And I think that's a good starting point to be honest about.
Literally, like, I'm having just so many great thoughts, and I'm glad that we're figuring this out in real time.
I know.
Mean, you've had a lot more hours in this space, so it's, and years, but hearing you say that, it sounds like there is a dual responsibility, because there's a responsibility for us to be able to not censor ourselves, to be able to express ourselves, to be able to realize there's more options. But so much of that rests on not feeling like someone's going to ostracize and judge
us. Absolutely.
And I wonder, how do we start within ourselves? As you said, that's really where it starts.
Yeah.
You said a few moments ago that because people don't give themselves grace for their own contradictions, they can't have grace for other people's mm-hmm. contradictions. What is the process of giving ourselves grace for our contradictions? Because I think almost sometimes we don't even see them.
Yeah.
Like, I think sometimes we're just so self-unaware, and it's so funny. I consider myself to be quite a self-aware person. Yeah. And just 2 weeks ago, I was sitting there and someone gave me some honest piece of feedback. And I sat with it for the rest of the day, and I was like, I am so self-unaware. Mm. Like, I'm so self-unaware. And I thought about this weekend, I again got some good feedback from someone, and I was thinking, yeah, like, I don't even see how me acting that way could be perceived that way. But it is. And whether that's my intention or not, that's how it's perceived.
Yes.
But I'm so self-unaware. I'm not conscious of that. Yeah. And so even as someone who considers themselves very self-aware, I would consider myself to be not that aware. And so I think a lot of us are so self-unaware where we don't even know we have a contradiction. We're like, nope, I've always signed up for the same thing. I've always voted the same. I've always felt the same. No, this is who I am. So where do we start when we have no space for grace for our contradictions because we don't even know what they are?
I love that question so much. And I organized this book, but it's actually not even really about the book. I had to organize a lot of my own thoughts from my own journals and a lot of my work with clients because I'm a developmental coach and a researcher, and I'm trained in Jungian psychology. So my fascination, Jay, is really understanding the shadow of humanity, which is essentially what we're talking about. In that if you are willing to integrate and understand your shadow, you will experience a more fulfilling life. You will find yourself being in more integrity. So I organized the book in three parts: awareness, responsibility, and expression. And I see this as the journey of going from conforming, whether it's conforming to ideals and expectations of your past self, to a place of actual brave expression and courage. A lot of people want to rush to expression. What do I say? What do I do? Give me this strategy, Africa, or I've been canceled. What do I say? No. We have to start at awareness. What are you afraid of? If I express the truth, I believe that I will be punished. I believe that I'll be abandoned, rejected, whatever it might be. I truly believe that everyone has to start there. Be honest about what you're afraid of. When Jay tells me an opinion that I don't agree with and I'm very defensive and reactionary and I want to take him down, I'm afraid of something. What am I afraid of? Right? Is it because his worldview feels like a threat to my sense of self? Just be very honest. And then the second part where you're talking about contradiction falls into the responsibility aspect, where I ask the question, what do you stand for? And I always use another sort of mantra that I wrote, which says, when you don't know what you stand for, you will always be at the mercy of the external world. Mm-hmm. And that's really important. I'll say that again. Mm. When you don't know what you stand for, you will always be at the mercy of the external world. So if you come across someone who's more intimidating, someone you believe has more status, has more power, someone who maybe you believe is better than you in some way, or a mob, or someone who says you need to speak up in this exact way or use your platform, whatever it is, you will always be at the mercy of everything else. You will never consult yourself. You will always consult other people before you consult you. And to actually know what you stand for, you need to know what your values are, which I think is what we're talking about. And I think a really good place to spot your contradictions is to say, okay, what do I value? People will usually say things like, I value honesty, integrity, transparency, kindness. And it feels so good to say, this is what I value. It feels amazing. But then I like to go a step deeper to say, the results you see in your life right now in real time, in this moment in time, they will actually show you what it is you actually value. Mm. The state of your relationships, the state of your bank account, the state of your how you behave online, whatever it might be, that will show you what you actually value.
Recognizing the disconnect between stated values and real life outcomes leads to deeper introspection. As the conversation shifts to the intriguing dynamics of superiority and personal experiences in debate,
you have to be able to spot your need to exercise superiority.
It's such an interesting thing. You made me remember a experience I had back at school when I used to be part of my, I'm just going to sound super geeky, but yeah, I was part of my debate team at school. And
that's good.
And I really enjoyed it because it was such a great learning experience. So I remember one presentation, I was probably like, I don't know, 14 years old or something like that.
Yeah.
Like a young teenager, maybe 15. And we had this debate set up. I can't remember the motion. And I made a point that completely destroyed the other person's argument, and the whole, all my friends and everyone in the audience went crazy and was just like, oh, you showed him. Like, you know, it was like this big, like kind of moment. I was feeling myself and thinking I was amazing. And I talked to my teacher afterwards, who asked to see me after the presentation, and I'd won the debate.
Yeah.
And he said to me, he goes, Jay, did you win the debate today? And I was like, yeah. He said to me, how did it go for you today? I was like, well, we won. Like, it was great. And he was like, no, you didn't win. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, didn't you just see everyone applaud and like go, you know, go crazy? And he said, no, he said, you won the crowd, but you lost the debate. And I was like, what do you mean? And he said, well, he said, a good debate is where you have a deep understanding of the other person's space and place and insight. It's not that what you're saying proves them wrong. It's that you understand their argument so deeply that you're able to dismantle it on its own. It's not about yours being better.
Yes.
It's about you actually being to understand it so deeply that you're able to show that parts of it don't add up. And it was a really nuanced, profound point for me, because I just thought, if you win the crowd, then of course you win. And I think that's what the society we live in today, where it's like, if someone wins over the crowd, even if they're completely wrong, we're okay with it.
Yeah.
Right? Even if someone acts completely immorally, or we don't even know the truth, we don't know what happened behind closed doors, if they win the crowd, like if someone wins it on social media and they're in a legal case or whatever it is, and on social media it all goes well, even if we have no idea what that person's moral character is, we're with them. And you see this on shows, you see this everywhere. And again, I'm not saying we should judge them. I'm just saying we all believe if you win the crowd, you won. And so we've lost the ability to actually say, well, no, do I deeply understand? Can I actually get context of this person?
Yes, that just landed so, so strongly for me. Thank you for sharing that anecdote on the debate, because it's, I actually write about this and speak about it a lot because it's a big part of my story, my experience. But a lot of what you're saying directly parallels what I experienced in 2020. As I've said at many points throughout this conversation and kind of reference to that point in time, didn't get very specific. 2020 is when there was a big conversation around race relations after the killing of George Floyd in the US. And it ignited really important conversations that have transformed the way we speak about race, the way we interact with each other, the way we have started to just notice our conscious and unconscious biases. But I, again, at that time had already been doing the work that I do in understanding self-sabotage, self-censorship, how do we have brave conversations, etc. But this is all identity, right? Even as I'm saying it right now, it's I had been studying, I've been learning, I've been whatever. But there were aspects of what I was doing and grounded in that was just from the neck up, but hadn't been actually embodied. And I got to learn that in 2020 because I was one of the people for a very short time, but a very intense time, demanding that people speak up about what was happening in the States. And again, I use that language very specific because I'm not taking in the context of where people are in the world. What if Africa, someone doesn't have any idea of what has actually happened? What if it's someone from India or Kenya or Zimbabwe or, and I'm expecting them to speak up? Speaking up, meaning you have to do it online. It has to be a performance. You have to post something that is going to make me feel like, okay, you've done this the right way. So it's all ego. Because who am I as a individual person in West London, in my house, expecting the world? When you actually look at and speak about these things in this way, you realize just how it's not only self-righteous, but entitlement is a part of it as well.
That's the right word, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. That's the right
I
word.
Am entitled to your opinion. And there was just so much at play for me that was really humbling. So I was one of the people specifically on the Tuesday where people were being told to post a black square. I think most people listening to this will understand. And it was so out of character. But I think I have to even do a self-correction in real time to say, actually, no. It was a demonstration of what my character actually was. I thought that it would be out of character for me to do something like that, but it was in character in a way. But I was pretty much just demanding that people speak up about race in the way that I wanted them to. And you could look at it and say, yeah, you were inviting people to do something that was right and very important, but I was doing it in an extremely intolerant way, in a way that was pretty much not giving people an option to speak up in a different way. There was no sort of third perspective. There was no nuance. There was no consideration of maybe Africa people are speaking offline and I have a feeling so many people listening to this will remember that time and maybe the way they participated or what they experienced, because I've had so many enlightening conversations in the past 4 years about that time period. And I was applauded, Jay, so loudly for it, because I was essentially shaming those that were not speaking up, those that were not saying anything. And again, I would have never expected myself to behave in this way, but guess what? I did. And when I looked into it a little bit deeper over time, I realized that I was speaking in that way because I was afraid of what people would say to me if I didn't say anything. So it was almost like a performance. Again, that idea of keeping the mob at bay. So behaving in a way that you think will appease them, but then behaving in that way got me applauded. So the thing about the crowd. Instantly, also because of the time period, everyone is pretty much online. We're on lockdown in most parts of the world. So the digital space was just a very different place to be in. Things would sort of just spread like wildfire. So all of a sudden, I'm having thousands and thousands of people applauding me and cheering me on, telling me that I'm doing the right thing. And then I have this man who sends me a message. He sends me a DM. And he says, Africa, I've been following your work for a while. I really respect what you do and you've helped me a lot. But I just wanted to ask you, do you think that this is the right way to bring people together? Because again, I'm saying that I want unity. I'm saying that I want open conversations. I'm saying that I want tolerance, but my actions are in complete contradiction. So someone that had a bit of an understanding of who I am and what I supposedly stand for is saying, hey, do you think that this is the approach to take? Instead of responding to him and even sitting with it for a while to kind of be curious about where he was coming from, I immediately shamed him.
Reflecting on the complexities of unity and personal accountability, the conversation shifts to a shared cultural experience, where laughter masks deeper truths about our upbringing and the lessons we carry forward.
we were all African in this setting, and we were laughing about being hit as children. Because it was just the normal...
Normal in Indian families.
Exactly,
too.
Exactly. You kind of laugh about it. Everyone got beads, everyone whatever. And we were saying, but it didn't work. And it didn't even really work for our parents either. But it's like we do this thing because it's always been done. And because you become afraid, it looks like it works. Which reminds me of kind of pretty much what we're talking about. Because someone is afraid and they apologize from that place of fear, we believe that it's worked. We don't actually care to know whether they've actually embodied that apology. Are they truly taking accountability? Do they even think they need to take accountability for it? Or is it to keep that internal and external mob at bay, you know? But I think even though it sounds very idealistic, I think grace is truly the antidote of so much of this, but I don't think it's about immediately grace for others. It's grace with the self. And grace with the self is projected onto others, whether we like it or not. Because another thing that I wrote in my journals was a question to myself around that time in 2020. And I was saying, can you truly be fulfilled in life and still participate in cancel culture?
Wow.
Can you truly be fulfilled in life and still participate in cancel culture? Because if we're having this conversation of binary, I realized that maybe an answer could be, yeah, you can still be fulfilled and maybe dip in and out of but I don't believe it's possible.
Why?
I don't believe that you can truly be whole within yourself, because to be whole is to accept your shadow, is to integrate the messy, gross parts of you that you would rather just keep behind closed doors. But you have to meet them. You have to be with them. You have to understand that they'll, other times your shadowy self will come out to play a little bit more, but then you have a conversation and then it's a constant dance. Sometimes you might need the shadowy parts of yourself in different ways, but I truly don't believe this is where I'm more than happy to be convicted in that you can't be truly fulfilled in who you are as a person and participate in the dehumanization of anyone and anything.
That's super intense and powerful at the same time, because there's a sense of what I'm getting from listening to you, that when we see other people's shadows, we're so deeply reminded of our own that we have to project this belief that theirs exist bigger than ours. Or there's a feeling of, if someone shows their shadows, it gives me the excuse to continue to show mine. And so your imperfection allows me to continue to be imperfect and not grow.
It's both.
And
I've never heard anyone put it in that way. Oh, this is good. I'll give an example of the last one you've just said. Like almost like if you show your shadow, it's a permission slip for me to keep showing mine without ever questioning it.
Yes.
Or ever, sometimes people that are uncomfortable with my work, which by the way, you can tell me, I think it's fairly non-controversial. I think what am I really saying? I'm saying that we need to be willing to understand differing viewpoints without feeling like we have to take them as a part of ourselves. I'm saying that we are braver than we realize. We need to push back against this culture that says we need to be constantly monitoring what we're saying and self-editing. I just don't believe we need to be doing that. But there are some people who will say, well, Africa, do you think some really dangerous people could come across your work and they will use it as an excuse to say really hateful things, to say really et cetera things, whatever the thing might be? And then I always come back to, why do we always have to see, why is that the default response, right? Why do we always have to go to those extremes? Are you an extreme person who's resonating with my work? Why do you believe that you can be nuanced but other people can't be? Why do you believe that you can take what you need from what I say but other people can't? It's that thing that you were saying before around how we believe that our approach is the best way. Only I can decipher this work, but what if someone dangerous comes across? It's like we need to grace. It comes back to grace again. Can you have the grace to believe that other people are actually more rational than you've been made to believe? And we see in our everyday lives, you were so right when you were saying for the average person, when they walk out into the world, it's rare for them to experience something that is so it's rare mm-hmm. because the norm is actually just normal people just going about their day and but in the same way you do. So yes. why do you think that you are the exception? Mm. Right? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. again, these are questions and things that I say to myself, yes, yes. Africa, why do you get to yeah, be yeah, yeah. the exception of someone that can encounter something supposedly dangerous and say, I don't resonate with this, but this is fine. Trust, give other people the grace and the good faith that they are able to do the totally, same.
Totally, totally. I meet more kind, reasonable, thoughtful,
yes.
genuine, sincere yes. people on a daily basis than I do the opposite.
Yes.
But the opposite feels so loud online mm. and so activated online and so amplified online
yeah.
that you can very well believe
yeah.
that kind people don't exist.
Yeah.
And I can honestly say that as we're talking about this, I want to understand from you why collective sabotage is the right terminology that you coined for cancel culture. Mm-hmm. And I want to dive into this. I've been waiting to get into it because I've really been wanting to honor each thing we're discussing and not
Absolutely.
Run through because it's sparking so many thoughts. And there's a sense of cancel culture holds people accountable.
Yeah.
It holds people responsible. It helps people own up to their mistakes or not even own up. It helps people, it helps justice
yeah.
be served. How could that possibly be collective sabotage? How could that possibly be a bad thing?
Even if we just look at the word, let's start with the word cancel and just try to think of the sort of synonyms we can mm. think of. To cancel is to delete, it's to eject. And then you can go even further, is to reject, is to, when something is cancelled, it's ended. It doesn't exist anymore. So I think it's a type of contradiction that doesn't really work for me in the sense that justice and deletion and ejection, they just don't work together. Mm. It's the kind of contradiction that actually causes chaos. Mm. So for me, the reason why I think it's important to really understand the importance of language when it comes to these issues is because we have a definition issue. Mm. We just do. I think a lot of the time, if we were both clear on the definition that we're working with, we would come to kind of similar conclusions, maybe different ideas about how to get there, but we'd be like, okay, that's fair enough. I don't know any reasonable person who wouldn't want people that have done harm to be held accountable, mm-hmm. to be truly held accountable. I don't know anyone that doesn't truly want progress, not some kind of utopian idealistic type, but progress that is grounded in the reality that works for most people.
Having navigated the complexities of accountability and language, the conversation shifts towards personal authenticity in interviews, exploring how understanding diverse perspectives shapes the narrative and influences connections.
I'm not going to stifle, curate, perfectly present because I don't want to be 30 years older and look back and go, gosh, I just don't know who I am anymore.
Absolutely.
And it came with who we had on the show. Like we had podcasts with guests that I remember when my comment section was Sunshine Land because it was just this small, beautiful place
mm-hmm.
where it hadn't yet scaled enough, but it also hadn't We weren't doing things maybe that pushed the boundary or pushed the envelope.
Right.
And as soon as we started to do that, you start to see the conflict. You start to see the disconnect. I guess the point I'm making is an interview didn't have to be me saying, I agree and accept what this person is saying, unless I actually say I agree.
Yes.
Maybe it was for me to understand someone's experience. Maybe yes. it was for me to understand someone's story, going back to your language of the difference. So when did an interview become an acceptance of someone's beliefs?
Mm.
Isn't the point of an interview to understand
yes.
someone's perspectives? And so I started to see, you know, judgment of what guests we had or whatever. Like, we, you know, I remember, again, this is the 1%. I want to say to the majority of people, but it's so interesting how you start seeing it. And it was like, I would see every time we had a celebrity clip, there'd be the 1% of comments that go, Jay, why are you only interviewing celebrities? I'm like, wait a minute, if you look at the 52 guests we had this
right.
year, I promise you there's not 52 celebrities in the world. And if you look at the guests, you'll probably find 2 to 3 guests a month that are not celebrities.
Yes.
And by the way, the celebrity conversations are also human conversations. They're humanized human conversations. They're still about mental health,
yeah.
well-being, personal experience. And so it's so interesting to me that you start having to explain everything. And then I got to a point where I was like, no, those who know me, know me.
Yes.
And those who don't, I truly wish them well. And I hope they do expose themselves to more of my work, because I think they will if they look beyond one episode or one page of a book or one clip for 30 seconds. And I hope that you do that. And I hope that I can connect with you one day. But I'm not going to try and cater and curate myself for the 1%, because I don't want to live that way. And I trust that the common sense and the lack of extremes is where the majority of the world lives. And that's where we all want to live together.
I love that. I love that so much, because it speaks to exactly what I had to do and what I encourage anyone who's even visible in some sense, especially online, to pay attention to where you might be creating an audience that will never allow you to change. Mm. Because that's what I noticed for myself in 2020. So after that thing happened and I was getting applauded for it, and there were people that dropped off, people that were like, this is so out of integrity compared to what you have said and who you are as a person. And I completely understand that now. People that could see the intolerance for what it was, maybe some dropped off silently, some might have said something, but the majority was the crowd and the applause and it triggering that sort of elation and power and arousal, whatever it might be. But once I changed my mind and sort of walked back that behavior and saw it for what it was, I had a lot of people drop off, people that didn't appreciate the nuance and the grade that I was bringing forward. There were many more, but again, it's that seemingly 1% or at least the minority, right?
Yeah, yeah.
There were people that thought that I needed to speak and think a specific way because I am Black, because I'm left-leaning, because I'm progressive, because I'm XYZ, whatever the identity markers are, there's an expectation for all of those things, you know? So when I did change my mind and started exploring a lot of the themes that I explore today, there were a lot of people that were very uncomfortable with that.
Imagine.
Similar to what you're saying about everything is fine when you're sort of abiding by what is expected, but when you deviate from that norm, there's a lot of teething issues and a lot of friction and a lot of, you know, creating space for new people to find you, whatever it might be. But a lot of people felt uncomfortable. But what I loved, Jay, is that a lot stayed. There were many that felt uncomfortable, but they stayed. There were very few that sort of declared their departure, which is always lovely when people announce that they're unfollowing. But I love that actually there were so many people that even in the discomfort, they stayed and they listened and they got what they needed. And that's where, again, I really choose to focus on the people that didn't allow the cognitive dissonance to sort of make them reject and cancel and discard and devalue everything they had got from you for however many years or however many episodes. People that chose to be like, okay, I don't quite like this. I don't get it, but I'm going to stay.
Yeah.
You know, and I think to me, that's the most beautiful part of of this. You get to be uncomfortable. You maybe get to have a little strop, but you stay. You stay and you find out why you feel that uncomfortable and you repair because it's conflict. You need to repair.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you accept. It doesn't mean we go to the to those extremes. Well, what if it's... No, we're talking about the common sense, everyday interactions of discomfort and a worldview that kind of pushes back against your own. You get to stay and you get to repair, if not with the other person, with yourself.
So beautiful and fully agree. Like, I can honestly say that too, that that's what makes me believe the work is happening.
Yes.
When we can sit in the discomfort and when we can look beyond also unsaid cliches. Like, I remember I've never been a proponent of the old cliche of money doesn't buy happiness. I've never written about it in books. I've never spoken about it. I'm never like, hey, you should never achieve something. Like, that's not who I am. That's not even my thought process. And but sometimes the background of Monk, people assume that's what you believe.
Right.
And it's so funny, I've never said it, but it's an assumption. I've never said it. It doesn't exist. Like, I don't, I've never said that, because I actually believe that people need to change their relationship with money.
Yes.
They need to be more abundant with it. And
me
that's
too.
Not just money, it's just
me
one
too.
Thing. But whatever else it may be, I don't believe a simple life and an ambitious life are incongruent. I don't believe that a minimalist life and extravagance or incongruence.
Having navigated the complexities of assumptions surrounding wealth and simplicity, the conversation now shifts to the importance of discernment in our convictions as we delve into the nuances of human understanding and transformation.
I encourage you to use discernment. And I also think it's okay to have your convictions where you can't be moved. Mm-hmm. Say, you know what? I could be understanding around this, but I'm going to choose to stay in this conviction. Mm-hmm. I think we get to do that when it comes to things like abuse, when it comes to human rights, when it comes to things that are just so disturbing and unfathomable. I have to make peace with the fact that people will deal with it how they wish to.
Yes.
But I'm speaking to that middle that exists for so many of us. And I believe that grace, even if we're so uncomfortable, is the only way you can understand. And that doesn't mean you accept. So I think that kind of...
answers both.
It answers both in different ways.
Yeah. I fully agree with you. And I'm glad I asked it because I also wanted to get that kind of like... Yeah. The encapsulated thought process almost of the belief system. And it's good to hear it that way because I agree with you. I think that humans have amazing ability to transform when given the opportunity. Mm. I also think that so much of the culture today writes people off over very little information, inaccurate, incomplete information, or misrepresented information. Mm-hmm. Like it's not even as clear. And also in not understanding what someone was even trying to say in the first place.
Absolutely.
And so it's coming from such a uneducated guess often. And like you said, going back to where we started, it's what we do to ourselves.
It's what we do to all of it.
We beat ourselves up.
If you didn't beat yourself up so much or shame yourself, often in unconscious ways, by the way, because I think so many people... Again, we have so many beliefs about who we are, what we stand for, etc. But our actions, especially our default actions and default responses, will show us what we're really working with underneath. Mm-hmm. But a lot of us do live in shame. Mm-hmm. A lot of us are very embarrassed about some of the things that we have done and said, the people that we were in the past. A lot of us are faced with our contradictions. We don't know what to do with them because we live according to labels, you know, whether it's ethnic labels, political labels, identity-based labels. So you believe that because I'm this label, I shouldn't think in this way. I shouldn't speak in this way. Why do I kind of like this person? So you're always grappling with so many things, but what do? You just shove them down and just hope that no one, you being no one, the first no one, no one ever discovers them, finds them, but they have to express themselves somehow. Totally. And that creates more shame. So I think because we're working with so much shame and we're not willing to do kind of the self-inquiry because it's not that comfortable.
Yes.
We just don't have the capacity to be graceful with anyone else. We just don't. Mm. Whereas when you look at even just one area of your own gross stuff, the kind of stuff that you're like, you don't know what you're doing. When you spot it in someone else, you're able to be a little bit more understanding. Mm-hmm. You can go the way of being off rejecting it because you're not ready to face yours. But if you can face yours, you'll be willing to kind of dance in the grays a little bit more. Yeah, or you just wouldn't participate. You might not say or do anything, but you would not participate in the sort of cancellation and takedown of that individual in the same way. Yeah. You would think there may be other methods for accountability and personal responsibility, but it just wouldn't be in line with dehumanization. Yeah. It just wouldn't be.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we get there, Africa, because I think sometimes people feel they've been so forgiving. They've been so graceful.
Yes.
They've given so much grace and it's been so exploited that now they're so scared of giving that.
But was that grace or did you just not have boundaries? Because there is a difference. Mm-hmm. You get to be graceful and still have boundaries. Mm-hmm. You get to say, I understand, but I will not accept.
Yes.
Some of us think grace is being passive or fawning.
Yes.
But that's not grace. Exactly. Grace is still very strong. It's convicted. Grace says, no, this doesn't work for me. I don't agree with that. But your heart is open.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, that's exactly
so grace is not having no boundaries.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's glad, good.
Yeah, exactly. No, we have to define these things because I think these words have such, again, they have their own connotations and baggage. Mm-hmm. And I think grace feels like this all-merciful, all-encompassing feeling of just, no matter what you do, I'm
just
right
take,
here.
Just take.
That godly grace.
Yes.
And this, again, it comes back to, the extreme conversation.
Yeah.
Where we're not talking about grace in extremes.
Yeah.
We're talking about grace in Absolutely. A very practical, robust.
And even the idea, even though I'm not a religious person, something mm-hmm. I love about religion is that so many of them share the same threads. Mm-hmm. It's like one big tapestry with all the same threads. And from my understanding, even a loving God has boundaries. Mm-hmm. The Ten Commandments exist. There are sort of principles mm-hmm. in which are the guiding systems. And to me, those principles are put forward in a very graceful way, mm-hmm. but they're still very boundaried.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
there are lines. There's still a level of needing self-discipline and control and not just a chaos, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. absolutely. There are so many amazing chapters in this book. I want to name a few chapters of my favorite that when you get the book, I want you to dive into deeply. Of course, read the book in order, but some of your favorites. Chapter 8, Be Quick to Listen, Slow to Speak. Mm. Beautifully put. Again, Africa's magician with words. So number 9, I love this because we talked about it, but not in this language. Honest conflict or dishonest harmony? And I know that I'd yes. rather live in honest conflict than dishonest harmony.
Yes.
Did you want to say something to that?
Do
you
no,
want to,
no, 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 no.
I'm just giving people the. If beautiful. You want to, please.
No,
dive
no,
in.
No. This is perfect.
This one is probably one of my favorite chapters as well. That's in there. You Owe the Internet Nothing. Chapter 4, really important one to read with the age that we're living in. And chapter 11, a great one to look forward to, one before the end, which is Brave Expression, A Price Worth Paying.
Mm.
And I can honestly say that in trying to bravely express myself, the freedom and liberation that I have felt internally is priceless, despite the minority experience of the external, the internal feeling. And I always ask myself, how will I feel about this at the time of death?
Mm.
I always ask myself wow. that because that's the price worth paying for, because at that point, I'm not going to think about comments and I'm not going to think about DMs and I'm not going to think about followers. I don't think any of us are. I don't think any of us in that moment are going to go, oh, well, I wish more people agreed with me or knew who I was or knew what I stood for. I don't think that's going to be what's going through my mind. It's going to be, did I serve? Did I live? Did I allow myself to be? And did I become all of who I felt like becoming in order to help and improve the lives of others and share everything I had to share? Those are going to be the questions I ask. So why not make those the questions now? Because I will only answer those questions if I ask them now.
Yeah.
I will only find the answers for the rest of my life. But if I wait till the time of death to ask them, I'll have no time to answer them.
That's it for today's summary. To stay up to date with more summaries and news, follow us on X and Instagram and visit our website, podsummarizer.xyz. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or complaints about the content displayed, please do not hesitate to write to us at info@podsummarizer.xyz. Thank you for listening.